Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I will try to avoid having a large menu with too many items. And I will try to have a menu that is the menu of the day and cook fresh food on a daily basis in small amounts. And when you run out of it, you close the restaurant.
That's celebrity chef Eric Repair. He gives advice for how small restaurateurs can survive during the lean months for business. Abby Fentress Swanson of Harvest Public Media reports on how safety concerns are threatening the specialty cheese market. In the second half of our show, we speak with Paul Kinstedt, the author of the book Cheese and Culture. Then in the kitchen, broiled grapefruit with a twist and Welsh cakes, two awesome breakfast recipes. Stay with us. Here are our foodie news headlines, courtesy of Mia Partlow. Hey there.
Three stories from the wires today. According to a study released by the conservation group Oceana, some 33% of fish sold in the United States is mislabeled. Over the course of 2 years, Oceana collected over 1,200 samples across 21 states from 674 retail outlets. Oceana used DNA to determine if the fish being sold was actually what it said it was. The group declined to list the names of restaurants and grocery stores where they purchased the fish they tested, stating it's hard to find where in the food chain the mislabeling occurred. There are several issues with mislabeled fish. Consumers may think they are ordering and paying for a more expensive fish when it's actually a cheaper fish. Incorrect labeling also means consumers are unable to make informed choices about sustainable seafood. Perhaps more troubling are the health concerns. Fish listed as "do not eat" by the FDA for sensitive individuals was being passed off as safer fish. For instance, tilefish as red snapper and halibut in New York City. Some critics have demanded a crackdown on mislabeling, saying giving fish ID numbers would make them more traceable. The federal government is contemplating making a change to its long-standing food aid program by substituting donations of actual food with donations of cash. Cash donations are already favored by most aid-giving countries because they are faster and more efficient to execute than food donations. The United States has favored food donations since the Food for Peace program went into effect in 1954. Sending food aid instead of financial aid had served the dual effects of feeding hungry people and creating a new demand and market for American foodstuffs once the country receiving aid rebuilt its economy. While the White House has not yet issued a statement about the proposal, switching to the cash method presents a possible way to cut back on expenses without cutting back on aid. And this past week, First Lady Michelle Obama made appearances to commemorate the third anniversary of her healthy eating initiative, Let's Move. On Wednesday, Mrs. Obama was with celebrity chef Rachel Ray in Mississippi to highlight healthy school lunches. And on Thursday, she was in Chicago for an event called Bringing Physical Activity Back to Schools. According to its website, Let's Move is dedicated to solving the challenge of childhood obesity within a generation. Perhaps the biggest accomplishment for the initiative was the passage of the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act of 2010. Late last year, however, the USDA responded to complaints that the new regulations left students hungry at school and put undue burden on local school districts. As a result, there is now more flexibility with regards to grains and meat in school meals. Read more about these stories and many more on our website, eartheats.org. And connect with us on Facebook and Twitter for foodie news updates throughout the day. Just search for Earth Eats.
Thanks to Mia Partlow for bringing us the news headlines at the top of every show.
See you next week.
Sales of specialty cheeses sold in U.S. grocery stores grew 7% last year, in large part because of increasing demand for exotic artisanal cheeses and even raw cheeses made from unpasteurized milk. Raw milk cheese has gathered a fervent following for its taste, nutritional benefits, and freshness. But as Abby Fentress Swanson reports for Harvest Public Media, recent safety concerns threaten the market.
I've spent a lot of time in front of cheese coolers in my life. That's because I love cheese, whether it's Stilton, Gruyere, or Drunken Goat. But raw milk cheese? That's new to me. So I asked Noah Earle, the grocery manager at Clover's Natural Market in Columbia, Missouri, to recommend a raw milk cheese for me to try.
I thought I'd choose a couple cheddars, if you're game.
Cool. We head to the back of the store and slice up a shiny yellow raw milk cheddar.
Okay.
Ready?
Yeah.
Hmm. I wasn't really expecting that.
No.
It's very smooth. It's smoother in consistency than the one we just tried.
Mm-hmm.
We were just eating that raw cheese straight, but Clover's customer Senyata Markey likes her raw cheese on top of apples. In fact, she doesn't eat cheese unless it's raw because her blood's type A.
Type A is, just because of our biology, do not digest dairy well or meat, and we're unable to assimilate the nutrients from those products. Now, mainly when it comes to dairy, I feel like it was part of the pasteurization process that makes it unavailable to me. And so the raw cheese, I could eat.
Consumers like Markey believe that raw cheese is more nutritious because pasteurization hasn't killed living beneficial organisms in the milk. But not pasteurizing can also allow harmful bacteria to live. And contamination problems have been a challenge for Missouri cheesemakers lately. Morningland Dairy in Mountain View, Missouri, just went out of business after the state milk board seized 36,000 pounds of its raw cheese because some of it was found to be contaminated with listeria and staph. Also in the northwestern part of the state, three people got sick after eating a raw cheese called Flory's Favorite. A batch of it tested positive for E. coli. Nebraska cheesemaker Krista Dittman says these problems can be devastating for the raw milk industry.
I think it creates a lot of fear in the industry, and it creates a lot of dissonance between producers and regulators.
Dittman's talking about the feeling from small producers that inspectors from state agriculture departments and the Food and Drug Administration, which regulates the raw milk cheese industry, will never find their operations to be clean enough or safe enough to meet their standards. Morningland Dairy's lawyer Pete Kennedy points out another fear.
Well, I think it creates a chilling effect on other people getting into the business. You know, you're going to spend all that money on equipment and a plant if something like this can happen.
But the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention say raw milk cheese poses a very real threat, sickening hundreds of people over the past decade. A few years ago, the FDA began a comprehensive risk assessment of raw milk cheese, which can be sold legally nationwide as long as it has been aged 60 days. The FDA is expected to release its findings by the end of September, and some producers worry the agency will extend the amount of time required to age raw cheese, or, worse, ban the sale of raw cheese across state lines. But food safety expert Richard Raymond wouldn't mind a raw milk cheese ban.
The pasteurization of milk, which became more or less the standard in the 1940s, dramatically dropped the incidence of foodborne illnesses, particularly in children, because it's a very simple step to guarantee the safety of the milk.
Back at Clover's, a regular named Kathy Lane stands in one of my favorite spots at the cheese cooler and gazes at the dozens of delectable cheeses available for sale. She and her 11-year-old daughter don't eat products made from pasteurized cow's milk due to antibiotics that might be found in them. But she's still debating whether or not to try raw milk cheese.
Would you ever consider raw milk or raw milk cheese?
Good question. I'm not sure. I mean, I would try it, but I'm not sure.
For the raw milk cheese industry, that uncertainty is a familiar feeling. Abby Fentress-Swanson, Harvest Public Media.
Read and listen to more stories from the reporting team at Harvest Public Media on their website, harvestpublicmedia.org. Eric Repair became executive chef at the New York City restaurant Le Bernardin in 1994. The following year, he earned a 4-star rating from the New York Times, which he was awarded 3 additional times, making Le Bernardin the only restaurant to hold that distinction. Oh, and he achieved all of that before he turned 30. These days, Repair is perhaps best known as a guest judge on the reality cooking show Top Chef. I spoke with him last year about being a conscientious omnivore, how to run a successful small restaurant, and whether or not he feels a responsibility to have his customers' long-term health in mind when he cooks.
Well, it's 2 things. When you talk and when you are on TV or with a journalist and talking about nutrition or healthy food and so on, and what you can serve in your restaurant. So when someone comes to the restaurant, very often the person is seeking an experience, is looking for something special. And therefore, you're not necessarily caring if it's the right amount of starch, fiber,
the exact amount of calories that the person should have. So when you compose a dish, you don't think like that. Now, when you talk about it, you should definitely be concerned by the health, your own health, the health of the people you are feeding as well. It's a little bit of a paradox and contradiction. The way we cook here is fairly healthy, but again, my priority is to create a very harmonious dish, a delicious dish. But at the same time, in the back of my mind and by instinct, the way we cook here is fairly healthy. But I will certainly not go on television and encourage people to eat a cheeseburger in between two donuts, that's for sure.
Let's talk about your studies of Buddhism. Talk about how you can reconcile killing animals for food with your beliefs.
Well, it's definitely something that I'm thinking about very often. Buddhism doesn't necessarily ask you to be a vegetarian. So by nature, we are omnivores. But what I think is important in killing animals and eating animals is to have the respect for the soul of the animals. It's to try to kill the animal in the most efficient way without creating suffering. I will add another element is that we have to think also about sustainability. So all those things are in my mind. Now, as you know, when you catch fish, especially from big boats and so on, the fish suffers, definitely, because it's out of the water and it's a long process. It's something that I'm thinking about, and hopefully in the future we will find some techniques to make sure that the fish is killed immediately and so on. I don't have a guilty trip, though, but once a year I ask some lamas in Nepal and in Bodh Gaya in India to do a ceremony which is lighting 1,000 lamps, and it's an offering to the soul of the animals that we have killed and served at the restaurant.
Let's talk then about the culture of factory farms. This sort of piggybacks onto that idea. Factory farms don't exactly have a stellar track record when it comes to treating animals with respect, in life or in death.
That's for sure.
As a restaurateur, how do you fight that? And as, you know, someone who just cooks in my kitchen myself, what can I do to change the culture?
You know, I mean, at a restaurant here, it's an expensive, luxurious restaurant. I can buy from small farmers. It's an extra cost. A lot of people cannot necessarily pay for an animal that is humanely raised, which means your lamb or your beef or duck, etc., or chicken, was running in the fields, happy, enjoying life until you slaughter him. The majority of the food that we see in markets, especially when it's affordable, it is true that they are raised in factory farms and therefore have a miserable life and they suffer a lot. What we can do is maybe allocate more money to the budget of eating, also changing some of the habits of eating and eating less meat protein during the week. That will encourage small farmers to create some businesses that are sustainable and also create a better environment for the animals.
Well, and let's now go to start to talking about cooking food. You guys sort of have a similar problem in New York City that we have in Indiana, that the growing season stops once we get the frosts and the
yes.
snow comes. So for people who want to eat locally, sustainably, year-round, who live in climates like ours, what sort of advice would you give them?
Well, you can always eat a lot of grain and root vegetables. However, you're going to go nuts. I mean, in the sense that you're going to be bored, not like it's dangerous for you. But you can try to avoid eating tomatoes and strawberries and raspberries and apricots and things like that in the middle of January because it's not in season. And therefore, you can have many other options. In terms of vegetables, you have, of course, carrots, turnips, parsnips, root vegetables, celery, etc. In fruits, you have pears and apples and citruses in the winter. But I think you have to find a middle way in between what is available in your region and what you really want and can bring and try to not be obsessive neither on eating only what you have in your region, being a locavore because it doesn't make any sense, nor bringing everything from 5,000 miles away.
Well, you mentioned parsnips there as a vegetable that you can eat in the wintertime. Give me some advice for cooking parsnips in an interesting way.
Parsnips is a great vegetable. It has a lot of flavor. I like it very much in puree, but I also like it cut in pieces and cooked with water, a bit of butter and salt. It's a very flavorful, very delicate vegetable.
And then another vegetable that everybody across the board seems to have problems with and wanted your advice on, eggplant.
No, the eggplant, it's not a difficult vegetable to cook. What you need to do is to peel the vegetable because the skin really very often is very thick and doesn't bring much. And then is to slice the vegetable in half an inch slice going lengthwise. You put a little bit of salt on top of it and you let it like that for half hour to an hour and you will see some water come up on top. And the salt will take most of the bitterness that the eggplant can have. And then you can saute your eggplant with some oil and garlic and onions and in cubes or in slices and eat it like that, like a steak almost. Eggplants are delicious.
So you're a successful restaurateur. Bloomington, Indiana is a college town. So restaurant business, as I understand it, really ebbs and flows when the students are in town and then when they leave over the winter and over the summer. So give some tips for restaurants in this area about how to survive during the times when the students aren't paying money in their restaurants.
I mean, if I was running a restaurant there, what I will do is that I will try to avoid having a large menu with too many items. And I will try to have a menu that is the menu of the day or potentially the menu of the week and then have not too many choice and cook fresh food on a daily basis in small amounts, knowing that obviously it's a slow season. And when you run out of it, you close the restaurant.
Hmm.
When you have no more food, it's sorry, come back tomorrow. Because the bigger your menu is, the more you're going to have to spend money in paying salaries and the more you're going to have to spend money in terms of having ingredients. And you're going to lose a lot of the food because you don't sell it. I mean, I wouldn't do that at Le Bernardin because it's luxurious restaurant and we cannot say, hey, sorry.
Right.
It's too late. And we work only on reservations. So, but if you have a small restaurant, you're a small operator, I think people will appreciate the fact that they know that your food is very fresh and is cooked for the day and that at the end, instead of serving something mediocre, you're rather to close.
Well, Chef, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure, too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. You can read my entire conversation with Eric Repair on our website, along with other interviews with authors, farmers, and chefs. Find it all at eartheats.org. Coming up, Chef Daniel Orr got the condiments all set.
Well, you see some jam. You know how you know it's jam?
I have no idea.
Because jelly don't shake like that, baby.
That's the only bad joke in the second half of the show, I promise. The two breakfast recipes are what you should be looking forward to coming up. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods. Fresh, local, organic food with delis at all three locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels. At the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness, massage and yoga. More at touchstonewellness.com. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. ¶¶ Welcome back to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan. Every week, we speak with authors putting out everything from cookbooks to food history books, and we feature snippets of those interviews here on the program. Our book today is Cheese and Culture, A History of Cheese and Its Place in Western Civilization by Paul Kinstedt. History buffs, this is a book for you.
Cheese is this great story because it has a finite beginning. It starts in the Middle East, then moves from that epicenter over time in lots of different directions.
Here's 1 minute with author Paul Kinstedt, where he describes how cheese making eventually made its way to North America.
The founders of the Massachusetts Bay Colony and the New England colonies, the Puritans, came largely from regions in England that were heavy cheesemaking regions in the early 1600s. So the Puritans were the beneficiaries of centuries of refinement of hard English cheese technology, which they brought with them to the New World. And the Puritans develop export markets, particularly in the West Indies, ship lots of cheese down there. They build a cheesemaking industry back in New England and get into the rum trade and the molasses trade and the slave trade, and for 150 years become very wealthy off of that so-called triangular trade, of which cheese and butter are feeding into all the while. And as America moves west, it's the Yankee cheesemakers that are moving into New York State and Ohio and Indiana that then really develop the larger scale cheesemaking, and the factory system comes in. But it's descendants of New England and Puritan cheesemakers that are driving this entire cheese industry in this country for 200 years or more.
Thanks,
Annie.
Bye-bye. Read more about Paul Kinstedt's book and hear his thoughts on eating cheese made from raw milk on our website, eartheats.org. You know what they say, breakfast is the most important meal of the day. Chef Daniel Orr couldn't agree more. He's preparing two easy dishes today, the first of which uses fresh citrus fruit.
I heard you didn't like grapefruit. So today we're going to come up with a grapefruit dish that hopefully you will like. Kind of like a grapefruit brulee. So basically all we do is we'll cut the grapefruit in half, and this is the ruby red grapefruit, which tend to be sweeter than a normal grapefruit. Cut this around the peel, so you're just doing kind of a circle, just kind of releasing the grapefruit from the peel, but leaving it inside. And then if you want to be fancy, you can go through and cut between each one of those little segments, and that will really make it easy to eat if you have a grapefruit spoon. All right, so then what we do is we take a little brown sugar. We're going to just kind of coat this with the brown sugar and then put it up under the broiler. If you have one of those little blow torches, you can also just use a little blow torch on it, and you want it to caramelize. All right, so I'm going to just go put it up under the broiler.
Yeah, who would have thought to broil a grapefruit?
I know.
Well, let me ask you, so who thought to broil a grapefruit?
My mom used to always make this for us. And it was a way to get kids to eat grapefruit, so... All right, and we're going to make this little broiled grapefruit into something a little more adult. I've got some griotine, which are brandied French cherries.
All right.
They're seedless sour cherries in a sugar brandy syrup. All right, I'm just going to put this in the serving dish. We'll put a few of these cherries on top, maybe just a little touch of the liquid, and that's it. That's our wonderful broiled grapefruit, and it'll make a grapefruit lover out of even the most timid of citrus people.
Okay, I'm keeping an open mind. Well, it's more palatable. Still not my favorite. It's tasty for someone who likes grapefruit.
Well, it's an old-timey dish, and I think a lot of people in the Midwest have grown up with this. Well, you see some jam. You know how you know it's jam?
I have no idea.
Because jelly don't shake like that, baby. But today we're going to make the Welsh cakes. And Welsh cakes are a lot like English muffins. They're a type of griddle cake. What we do is we're going to make the dough. So we have 1 cup of plain flour. Okay. We have 3 ounces of granulated white sugar. And traditionally in England, they would use currants, but I'm going to use some dried cherries today. You could use dried cranberries, you could use currants, you could use raisins, whatever kind of dried fruit you like. All right, I'm going to put in a half teaspoon of sweet seasoned spices, and that's one of my favorite spice blends. But if you don't have that, you could use pumpkin pie spice or Chinese five spice, or just some plain cinnamon. I'm going to add some baking powder, a half teaspoon of that, and that's going to be our leavener. We're just going to stir that around a little bit with our hands, and then I'm going to add the butter, and we're going to add 6 tablespoons of butter. And we're just going to work that into the flour with our hands, and what you're looking for is kind of a cornmeal-like consistency. You don't want to overwork it. You want your butter to be nice and cold. It's kind of like making biscuits in a way. And you can see it's starting to turn kind of yellow. So we've really worked that into kind of a cornmeal-like consistency. We're going to add an egg to that and just a little splash of milk. And we're just going to work this into a dough now.
So all this just with your hands?
Just with your hands, yeah. No reason to dirty the mixer. And then you want to have it to a consistency where you can roll it out, and we're about right there. So we're going to put some flour on our table, remove the dough from the bowl, and just kind of pat that out to even consistency. Now I've got my rolling pin. I'm just going to dust that with a little bit of flour so I can roll this out evenly. Okay, you can use a ring cutter or a jar, or I'm using a little measuring cup. Just going to cut little rounds. And we're going to take these over to the stovetop, and we're going to cook them in a little bit of butter and until they're golden on both sides, which takes about 3 minutes per side. You don't want your heat too high, because then, of course, they'll burn before they're cooked. So this recipe makes 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. You got 10 good ones and one extra one for the cook.
Recipes and photos for these dishes are on our website. Leave a comment to let us know what you think, eartheats.org. Thanks to everyone who helps make Earth Eats possible, including Ben Alford, Ayabon Binder, Sarah Gordon, Paul Kinstedt, Liz Leslie, Daniel Orr, Mia Partlow, Eric Repair, and the entire team at Harvest Public Media. And a big welcome to our new intern, Caroline Hoven. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, fresh, local, organic food with delis at all 3 locations and a garden center on East 3rd Street, bloomingfoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, 1 block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Designscape Horticultural Services, designing sustainable growth for a changing environment for over 25 years, building living soil for edibles and ornamentals with enhanced compost tea, and boosting plant health by enriching soil biology. 812-988-8900 or designhort.com. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. And thank you for listening. Till next week, happy eating. I'm Annie Corrigan.